Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 124 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm or download us after broadcast as a podcast. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you'd stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at an organization you're a member of, on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. Currently, you can donate via PayPal using david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.html for more information. Robert Darby is an independent researcher and freelance writer from Canberra, Australia, who has specialized in circumcision issues as well as many other things. He has a PhD in Australian literature and politics, and his interests in medical history and ethics arose after that time. He's the author of A Surgical Temptation, The Demonization of the Foreskin and the Rise of Circumcision in Britain from 2005, and The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Why Can't the United States Stop Circumcising Boys in 2012. In 2013, an article was published in the Journal of Medical Ethics, Risks, Benefits, Complications, and Harms, Neglected Factors in the Current Debate on Non-Therapeutic Circumcision. And his website on this topic is historyofcircumcision.net. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hi there, David. It's nice to be talking to you.
Yes. How did you get interested in the subject of circumcision in the first place?
Well, I really started by looking at the history of circumcision in Australia. I guess there were partly personal reasons and partly because I'd sort of noticed that whereas my generation had largely been circumcised, the next generation, or my sort of nephews and the sons of my cousins, they all weren't. So I was quite interested in sort of looking into why this sort of practice had started and when it started. So I began by writing an account, a fairly long account, of the origins of routine or non-therapeutic or prophylactic circumcision in Australia. That was published in some conference proceedings back in about 1999. Mm-hmm. But I found that the real history of circumcision in Australia, you'd have to go back to Britain, because basically Australia followed the British model, both in terms of medical education and most of the doctors here were trained in Britain. So that's how I went and researched my long book on the rise and fall of circumcision in Britain that you referred to.
Right. We'll get into some of the reasons why doctors have promoted circumcision over the years in a little bit. But I wanted to read something you had written about circumcision being a unique intervention, and you wrote in your 2013 paper, it's a unique intervention because it, one, involves prophylactic, which means preventive, two, amputation of, three, a component of a highly significant body part, four, without the consent of the subject. And I think that encompasses a lot of the issues from your position of why you're opposed to circumcision. But what is the purpose of the foreskin? And so if there's anybody out there who doesn't know what circumcision is, it's the removal of the foreskin of the penis in usually infant boys. So what is the anatomical functional role of the foreskin?
Well, I'll get into that in a moment, but I just want to make one point that I don't see that you have to prove that it has a function in order to be allowed to keep it.
Right.
Even if it didn't have a function, it's a normal body part.
Right. I have lots of things around my house that have no function, but I would hate to give them up. So
exactly.
I can see if it's part of your body that you might feel the same way.
Yes, well, precisely. So long as it's not actively malevolent, there's actually no reason why you should remove it. But in fact, I think the foreskin has quite significant sexual functions. It undoubtedly sort of contributes to sexual sensation and allows a greater range of sexual possibilities compared with somebody whose foreskin has been removed. It also sort of protects the glands of the penis and keeps it sort of moist. In the juvenile boy, the foreskin helps to keep the penis clean because it prevents, it's usually like a valve and it's quite tight, so it stops dirt from entering and allows urine to exit.
I mean, that is one of the interesting things about the foreskin is that for an infant up to pre-puberty, the foreskin is pretty much tightly wrapped around the penis, just leaving the small opening for urine. But is about the time of puberty, it loosens up and then is retractable.
Oh, that's highly variable. I mean, boys vary enormously as to when the foreskin becomes retractable. In some cases, it may happen within a year or two of birth. Mm-hmm. In other boys, it may not, as you say, it may not happen until shortly before or even shortly after puberty. The point is, a lot of people get anxious in infancy if it doesn't become retractable, very soon. And they then attempt a lot of misguided efforts to sort of force it back. That can do a lot of damage to the two structures.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things in medicine. They have their, the percentiles. And if you don't walk or talk or your foreskin doesn't retract by a certain time, there's something wrong with you. Whereas actually humans have a wide range of normal, if we can call it
that.
Yes,
exactly. It's an organic process. And like many organic processes, it can take its time. And it's usually not necessary to hurry it. I might add that while circumcision was, phimosis, which is the loose term for a tight or non-retractable foreskin, though it's actually more to it than that in the scientific sense, was often given as a prime or the major indication or reason for circumcision. But in fact, these days, the problem can, in most cases, be fixed with various medications, various steroid-based ointments, and these are now very effective in solving the problem.
That seems like a much less intrusive intervention.
Indeed, and your foreskin as well.
Yes. Can we just dispose of two? We're really talking about non-therapeutic removal. So let's first talk briefly about the religious origins of circumcision. And if I understand correctly, Judaism, it's pretty much mandatory. Is it also in Islam or just certain sects of Islam that...
Well, I'm not a big expert on the religious reasons for circumcision. Certainly, as you know, the Genesis 17 requires fathers to circumcise their boys. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other rules in Judaism which people don't necessarily observe these days, but that's one of the rules many do observe. It's a little bit different in Islam because while circumcision is regarded as a sign of piety and faith, etc., there's no obligation placed on parents to circumcise children.
And are there Jews? I mean, you might not know this, but are there Jews who say, "Well, I just don't think it's a great idea from a health and medical perspective," or do pretty much anybody who's semi-observant go along?
Oh, I think there's quite a strong, certainly in the United States and Israel, relatively large numbers of Jews are in fact abandoning circumcision. Mm. And if you look at the grassroots circumcision movement in the United States, there's actually a disproportionate number of Jews active in that. So I think while it's still very much a minority who are tending to reject that particular practice, they're nonetheless coming into existence. I don't think there's much evidence of rejection or abandonment of circumcision in the Muslim world, but we are beginning to see Islamic critics of circumcision emerging, and I've seen three or four you know, voices now beginning to question the practice. So that's another sign.
Right. And later I want to talk about a comparison with what's now called female genital mutilation, which, although it's prescribed by certain religions, is generally forbidden by most governments. But we'll do that in a little bit. I wanted to talk also briefly about therapeutic circumcision. Like, how often is it necessary for a medical reason to remove the foreskin of a boy?
Yeah, well, there can be situations. I mean, there's a number of possible situations. Traumatic injury, frostbite, gangrene, which could conceivably happen as a result of a wound or something. Also, recurrent urinary tract infections do appear to be slightly more common in uncircumcised boys. Usually these can be cured with antibiotics without too much trouble, but in some cases they keep coming back. Right. And where that happens, and where it's reasonable to circumcise in those circumstances. Also, severe phimosis with a condition called BXO, or Balanitis Erotica Obliterans, otherwise known as lichen sclerosis. This is a very, it's a condition of very obscure origin. Nobody quite knows what causes it, so it's not well understood. But what happens is that the foreskin kind of dries out and cracks and develops a kind of whitish film. And sometimes this can be cured by steroid and other medications. Sometimes it can't. Right. And where it can't, again, it's reasonable to circumcise.
Right. Okay, well, that's interesting. So
asked about the frequency of these conditions. Mm-hmm. These are all very rare conditions. There was a very comprehensive survey of Danish boys. In Denmark, there's no prophylactic or routine circumcision. Mm-hmm. Nobody is circumcised routinely. There was a very comprehensive study of how well the boys fared, and it was found that about 5% of boys had some sort of foreskin problem which required treatment. About 2% required surgery of some kind or another, but less than 1% actually required circumcision to correct the problem. So the numbers actually needing circumcision for therapeutic reasons is very small.
Right. So the need exists, but it's a pretty rare situation where...
Exactly.
Where...
I mean, it's the kind of thing where if a problem arises, you can treat it as it arises. There's no reason to circumcise every boy simply because, you know, 1% of boys might develop recurrent urinary tract infections.
Right. I mean, it kind of reminds me of breastfeeding. There are rare cases where a woman cannot breastfeed and there's no alternative way to get breast milk. And for those, formula is required, but it's actually probably only required in less than 1% of cases. And yet the formula companies would love to have 100% of babies formula fed because it's profitable.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned breastfeeding in the context of urinary tract infections because there are a number of studies have shown that one of the most effective ways of preventing urinary tract infections is breast milk, and particularly the mother's breast milk is highly effective as a protective agency.
Right.
So we should be encouraging breastfeeding in all ways because it helps give the boys the antibodies they need.
Yes, yes. So if the breastfeeding rate went up in society, then the fraction of boys with these urinary tract infections would go down, and
That's
the number
right.
that would need therapeutic circumcision would go down. So that would seem a very non-intrusive way that would also have many other side benefits, because obviously breastfeeding doesn't just have this one benefit. It's got many benefits. But let's talk about this prophylactic circumcision that's supposed to have, some people say it has benefits. A couple of those benefits are supposedly reductions of HIV and HPV based on an association with cultures that circumcise and the rates of those illnesses, I presume.
There's a number of benefits claimed, some of which are more valid than others. I think there's good evidence that circumcision of adult males in certain epidemiological environments, that is to say, African countries with very high rates of HIV in the population. And there's evidence there from three clinical trials that circumcision of adult males can reduce their risk of infection with HIV in one particular situation, which is namely unprotected intercourse with an infected female partner. But that risk reduction is not all that great. It's a 60% relative risk reduction, which just means that that circumcised men will take a bit longer to get infected. It won't give them immunity. But there is evidence. I think that evidence is fairly well established. But it doesn't necessarily mean that circumcision is the most effective method of preventing HIV transmission. There's no doubt that condoms worn even inconsistently gives you a better level of protection.
I have a very different view on HIV. I believe it's just antibodies and there is no such virus, but that's obviously not a mainstream belief. But what it is...
We won't go into that here.
What's that?
I don't think we'll go into that here.
Yeah, well, I've gone into it on this program, but not today. But it's still... Like with HPV, it still seems to be an association. It'd be very hard to causally show that this is actually effective.
Well there are certainly difficulties with the random clinical trials held in Africa because there's no certainty that the men who got infected had been infected by sexual means. Right. So there's a number of problems with those trials.
Right. And it's also true, like you said, for example, that Jewish women are less likely to get cervical cancer, and they obviously are much more, will normally have sex with a circumcised man. So that seems like a fairly tenuous correlation. It's a long way from a causative proof.
Well, the HPV you mentioned, that's human papillomavirus, that's now implicated in a number of genital cancers, both cervical cancer in women and also a number of genital and other cancers in males. That sort of observation was actually made quite early. It was made in the 1890s, the idea that circumcised men were less likely to infect women with HPV and thus with cervical cancer. But again, what that neglected was the fact that at that time the Jewish populations were much more segregated than they are now, so it was much more likely the result of less promiscuity rather than anything to do with genital anatomy.
I would imagine that Jews at that time, well, obviously they had a different diet if they were anywhere close to observant, and there were probably many other cultural factors that were different between that population and the rest of society. Many things would have been different.
It seems strange
to pick on one thing and blame that. But you raise an interesting ethical point, particularly with HPV. I mean, let's just accept that circumcision reduces the risk of cancer through the risk of HPV. You've got this chain where you're circumcising a boy because they will grow up and probably have sex, the majority will have sex, and therefore there's a possibility if they have sex with a woman that if they're infected with HPV that the woman will become infected, and there's a possibility, not a certainty, that if the woman is infected she will get cervical cancer. So there's a pretty long chain of things that could happen, and ethically you're circumcising this boy on a basis of that chain of probabilities, no certainties at all.
Yeah, well, I think that would be highly unethical, not only because it's a very tenuous chain of causation, but also because you're imposing a risk and a loss on somebody who's not reaping any kind of benefit. So I think that not only makes it unethical, it also makes it a very dubious legality.
Yes, I mean, I guess that's not the only reason for promoting circumcision. It seems like historically, one of the reasons, and this may have appealed to parents, was the supposed prevention or reduction in the frequency of masturbation.
Yeah, well, that was undoubtedly the major reason why circumcision became popular and was rapidly promoted in the 19th century. Very hard to realize, to appreciate these days, just how the sort of the ferocious opposition and fear of masturbation at that time, it sort of began in the early 18th century, but reached a peak probably towards the end of the 19th century. That's quite hysterical. Attitude to a perfectly, you know, what is a perfectly normal and universal human but activity common to all sort of primates, in fact. But it was not only regarded as highly immoral and improper, but also but was regarded as the cause of many diseases as well. People were supposedly, you know, I mean, diseases at that time, they didn't have a theory of, they didn't know about viruses and bacteria and that kind of thing. So if somebody got, for example, what we would now define as tuberculosis, it has many kinds of symptoms. But this could be attributed to masturbation because they're wearing themselves out.
Well, it's kind of like attributing a disease to a mosquito bite. You know, if you ask somebody, have you ever been bitten by a mosquito? The answer is probably going to be yes. And then you can say, well, that was what caused the disease in you. It seems not the most convincing explanation.
Indeed.
I mean, given that presumably masturbation is probably almost universal among boys and men to some extent. How could it possibly be associated with anything?
Well, what they did, the point is, they it wasn't, and they had a very broad definition of masturbation. It wasn't just, you know, teenagers after puberty sort of, you know, having a wank. It was infants and little boys will finger and fondle their foreskin pretty much all the time if they get the chance.
Right.
And this was also regarded as highly immoral and improper, and there were many ways sought to prevent boys from doing that. And it was eventually decided by a number of authorities, well, the simplest way to make sure boys can't do that is to cut it off, and that's what they did.
Okay, and I presume by reducing the sexual sensitivity of the penis is actually somewhat effective.
Well, there would certainly have been much less gratification from that kind of fondling as a result of removing that very sensitive tissue. That's right.
But one person we're going to talk about later, Brian Morris, who also published a paper on circumcision more recently, which is, I think, being withdrawn. He's a proponent of circumcision. He says it improves sexual functioning.
Well, I think there's been an interesting reversal in the advocacy of people who advocate circumcision between the 19th and the late 20th century, because, of course, in the 19th century and early 20th century, sex was regarded as a rather evil and bad thing. One of the leading sexual experts in mid-Victorian Britain, William Acton, believed that sexual activity was highly enervating and dangerous for men, so the less of it, the better. So they promoted circumcision on the basis that it would lead to less sexual activity and less sexual satisfaction. But post the sexual revolution of the 1960s, sex is now regarded as good and everybody wants it, and the more sex you have, the better. So naturally, if you want to advocate circumcision, you have to, at the very least, say that it won't harm your sexual experience. And ideally, you can, if you can then argue that it will improve your sexual experience, then, of course, that's even better.
Well, have we missed any claimed benefits? We've got the HIV, the HPV. We can throw away the prevention of masturbation. Is there anything else that's currently being promoted as a benefit of circumcision?
There's a general... If you look at the moderate position, the moderate pro, slightly pro-circumcision position now is that of the American Academy of Pediatrics. They don't recommend circumcision, but they say it can reduce the risk of sexually transmitted infections, HPV and HIV. As I say, there's evidence from Africa that circumcision of adults can reduce the risk of HIV transmission in unprotected intercourse, there's no overall evidence that circumcision can reduce the risk of transmission of other STIs. The evidence there is very contradictory and uncertain.
Right. There, I think the evidence is also contradictory on HIV. Like, I've seen papers that say the opposite of what you're saying. And I'll send you some afterwards, because I think the literature is nowhere near as clear-cut, even if you accept everything the mainstream says about HIV. So they don't have a lot of reasons. Like, basically, it reduces the risk of transmission of certain diseases, is what they're saying now is the main reason.
That's right. But I think what really lay behind the AIP's policy is the desire to protect circumcision from, that is to say, religiously and culturally motivated circumcision, and particularly to protect it from... See, at that time, you might recall, there were moves in California to try to prohibit circumcision legally,
right,
by legal means, and essentially that policy was a reply to those efforts to prohibit the practice.
Okay, so if you have an esteemed AAP, I presume is the American Academy of Pediatricians, if you have an esteemed medical organization saying that there's a small benefit, it's like, how can you ban something that has a benefit even though it's maybe small?
Yeah, that's right. It was that's exactly right. And in fact, the AAP has pretty much come out and admitted that, but they've said that, you know, that our policy wasn't, when we say that the benefits exceed the risks, we're not really talking about the average, you know, the majority of the population. We're really only referring to those parents who have a cultural or religious reason to circumcise.
So. Oh, really? So it only has a benefit when you have a religious motivation.
Right.
You also said that in the AAP paper, they noted that the support was so weak that they didn't want doctors to either recommend for or against, which isn't a very strong position, right?
No, well, that's right. It's a very equivocal. People have sort of said that it's a kind of change from their previous policies, but it's not really much of a change. And in fact, in some ways, it's less pro-circumcision than their policy of 1989, which was stressed that it had potential benefits. But I think it's important to realize that all the medical authorities in countries where routine circumcision was taken up, that is to say Canada, Australia, and the United States, in the early 1970s, they all issued policies basically against circumcision, trying to stop the practice. What's interesting is that these policies have had a very big effect in Australia, where circumcision has practically died out. Had a sort of moderate impact in Canada, but very little impact in the United States, where circumcision rates, they're now about a bit over 50%, but the decline has been very slow and has had a lot more to do with grassroots agitation than with the changes of policy on the part of the authorities.
Right. It seems a very, very timid policy from the AAP, like a tiny baby step. You mentioned that... In Australia, it's rare. Canada, of course, is heavily influenced by the United States. What about in most European countries? Is there...
Well, they never took up circumcision, so they've never had needed policies against it. The difference there is that with the increasing Muslim population in Europe, they're now finding they do need a policy on circumcision because, of course, the Muslim population... does circumcision. So both the Dutch Medical Association produced a policy in 2010, which is very strongly against circumcision, not merely on the basis that it has no significant benefits for the child, but on bioethical and human rights grounds as well.
Yes. I think it's a very interesting comparison with female genital mutilation, which I want to get to in just a little bit. But let's first talk about the harms of circumcision. And I kind of divided it based on what you'd written into the harms that always occur through the removal of the foreskin, and then the harms that are more serious and less common, you know, when something goes wrong. So what are some serious adverse effects that can occur during a circumcision? or after a circumcision?
Well, I'd define the harms a little bit differently. I'd define them in terms of physical harms, psychological harms, and moral or ethical harms. So in terms of physical harms, the first harm is simply the absence of any benefit. There's no significant benefit for the child in having his foreskin preemptively removed. And this is the view of all the child health authorities who've sort of issued policies on the matter. It's not really a matter of controversy. So the second physical harm is the loss of sexual functionality, reduced opportunities for sexual experience through not having a foreskin. And they're quite extensive and quite, again, but they're quite variable from one individual to another, but they're nonetheless very real. And the third thing are the complications that you referred to. Now, these are the surgical complications, things that go wrong, or unintended adverse effects like bleeding or infection. There's a condition called meatal stenosis, which is very common in circumcised boys as a result of the circumcision, where the urinary opening narrows and some often has to be surgically enlarged. Infections can be of all kinds. You can get gangrene, which can lead to a loss of the entire sort of genital area. Boys have died, for example, from meningitis as a result of infection through circumcision. There's a whole range of infections. Boys have bled to death as well because a baby boy doesn't have very much blood.
Right.
And you know, those and the foreskin is actually very richly supplied with blood vessels because it has a dense nerve network. So if you sever one of the major arteries and you don't notice, they can bleed to death quite quickly.
I don't know when you find out that a baby is hemophiliac, but obviously if you circumcised a hemophiliac, you could have a pretty serious problem on your hands.
Yes, well, in the days before effective blood transfusions, if you were the hemophiliac baby, had no chance of survival.
Right, right.
Even in Jewish tradition, if a parent, I think you had to have two sons die if they were hemophiliacs, but the third, if two sons had died, the third didn't have to be circumcised.
How thoughtful. That's kind of like the rule, isn't it? The rule in the U.S. military that if you lose when you they have to draft, that if you lost two sons, you didn't have to draft anymore.
Maybe that was the model. I don't know.
Yes,
but I did want to mention those other harms, the psychological harms. Many men deeply resent having been circumcised,
right.
And they have feelings of shame and humiliation. You may be aware there's quite a large community, online community, many thousands of men trying to restore their foreskins. So this is a sign of deep emotional distress as a result of losing what they regard as a normal or essential body part.
And is it possible to restore the foreskin? I mean, do you get any sensation back when you do that?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but certainly you can certainly, some men, if they're persistent, they can get remarkably good visual results. You can cause the skin to stretch.
Oh, I see.
But it's a very slow process. You've got to put a pressure on it. And it depends how severely you've been circumcised in the first place, depending how much sort of the foreskin tissue you've got left. The more you have, the sort of easier it is to do, and the less you have, the harder.
Yes.
And if I can just finish on the harms, I'd also include moral and ethical harms, which involve sort of the loss of autonomy and choice. There's also a principle in sort of legal ethics now called the child's right to an open future, which parents shouldn't needlessly sort of preempt options for their children. So, again, whether you keep your foreskin or lose it should be something a boy should decide for himself rather than having it, decided by somebody else.
Right. And one of the important points you made is that if there are benefits, they're largely related to supposedly sexually transmitted diseases, which, of course, you can't really get before sexual maturity.
Indeed.
And therefore, it would be perfectly reasonable to let a boy reach sexual maturity and then offer this, you know, intervention as a potential benefit. I mean, even if it's even if it is needed before a boy is 18, I mean, still a 13-year-old's in a much better position to make a decision than a 0-year-old.
Yes, well, I think the reason circumcision advocates are so keen for it to be done to babies is that basically babies can't say no.
And what percentage of 13-year-old boys or 16-year-old boys would say yes, you can cut my foreskin off?
Well, I think we're going to be pretty sure the numbers are going to be fairly small.
I think that would probably pretty much kill it. I wanted to quote something you took from the Royal Australasian College of Physicians about female genital mutilation, because I'd never really thought of these two things. Well, I guess I had thought of them in common, but let me read it. This policy points out that female genital mutilation, or FGM, is an injury to the external genitals. It is usually performed on girls between infancy and 15 years of age. It causes harm. It violates the human rights of the victims. It is performed on minors without consent. And although it is a practice authorized and recommended by some cultural and religious minorities, it is unacceptable in Australia. Now, is not everything that I read true of male circumcision, except the fact that it's unacceptable in Australia?
Yes, well, that's exactly what I wrote. Yes, that's right.
Yes. So, and you
it's
also...
Not the case, it's not only the case in Australia. I mean, that there are following the... It was a result of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1989 that most Western governments passed laws against female genital cutting. Mm-hmm. There were actually inquiries in Australia as to whether male genital cutting or circumcision should be covered. Interestingly enough, the Queensland Law Reform Commission in Australia did a lengthy discussion paper on this, and they actually concluded in that paper that circumcision was already unlawful under the normal laws of assault and wounding and sexual assault, etc. But they also realised that since it was a widely accepted practice, there was no point recommending any specific legislation to prohibit it.
Which is kind of interesting. One point you made that really surprised me was that you said that, you know, we understand there's a range of female genital mutilation, and some of it is horrible and brutal and affects women severely for the rest of their life. But you made the point that there is a, quote, ritual nick that's actually relatively benign, and even that is banned as female genital mutilation, and you said that's much less severe than male circumcision. Is that? Can you explain?
That's right. I mean, the thing about female genital cutting is it covers a range of actions, which mm-hmm. might be nothing more than a scratch on the vulva somewhere, right down to a severe clitoridectomy, which is probably what most people think of when they hear the word FGM. But clitoridectomy is not all that common. It's much more common for a much milder procedure to be inflicted. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge overlap, I think, between the outcomes for female genital cutting and male genital cutting. There's a big area where the degree of harm is very similar, a mere sort of scratch on the vulva somewhere is a lot less severe than a complete foreskin amputation.
Right. I mean, it's would you say that, a clitoridectomy sounds a lot more severe even than a male circumcision?
Yeah, well, undoubtedly a clitoridectomy is one of those words that's very difficult to pronounce.
I know.
Yes, there's no doubt that's more severe than even a severe circumcision. Anyone's going to argue about that.
Right. And I'm going to say that I just want to emphasize that I am opposed to all forms of female genital mutilation, and I'm guessing that the same goes for you. I can see, I know there are women, for example, who pierce themselves or get tattoos or something in that part of their body, which is their choice, right? Somebody may decide to put a ritual nick on their genitals for cultural reasons, but they should do that when they're of age.
Well, indeed, I've no objection to adults doing things to themselves, but what they do to minors is a different matter entirely. It's interesting how inconsistent the law is in this matter, because whereas there's a number of interesting cases in the United States where parents have been prosecuted for putting tattoos on boys, right. even where the boys actually wanted the tattoo, they've actually been prosecuted for causing injury and harm, whereas if the parent wants to circumcise him, he probably gets a rebate from the health insurance company.
Right, right. I mean, there's even debates over piercing your ears, right, which is a penetration of the body. And I remember my daughters really wanted it, and we came up with 8 years old as the age where we would allow it. But clearly an eight-year-old can't really make a decision. And that is a pretty benign operation. And it was obviously desired by the child.
Yeah, well, an ear piercing has got no comparison with cutting off
right,
the foreskin.
Right, yes. But even with something as benign as that, you know, some people frown on getting babies' ears pierced, which some people do. Even given the benign nature. But what's also the point you make is that all forms of female genital mutilation are generally banned in Western countries and also many other countries around the world, no matter how minor or benign they are. And yet male circumcision, which fits somewhere in the middle, is sometimes even encouraged to the point of reimbursing the procedure through health insurance.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It's highly inconsistent. There's no consistency there. That's right.
And I thought of another thing is that female genital mutilation used to be called female circumcision. I can still remember this. And then there was a movement to change the name. And I'm wondering if the reason to change was because female circumcision sounded kind of benign. It's only, I mean, boys get circumcised, so therefore female circumcision. And there was this attempt to say, no, it's much worse than that. And definitely in some cases it is, but you make the point that it's not always worse. And so there must have been the sensation or the feeling amongst the advocates against female genital mutilation that circumcision in males was actually a relatively benign thing.
Not only that, it was actually some of the advocates for male circumcision who objected to calling FGM circumcision because they were worried that the disapproval of female cutting would then be applied to males as well. So that was back probably in the early to mid 90s. There was the trend to change it from female circumcision to female genital mutilation. But the trend is now a little bit the other way, because it was felt that to call it FGM was perhaps demeaning to the women in cultures where it's normative and where, in fact, the women support this practice, because it's contrary to the view that it's some sort of patriarchal imposition.
Right.
Many cultures that practice FGM, it's the women who do it, and
right.
the women have regarded as their own sort of property. So we don't want to this comes from anthropology and the efforts to understand other cultures. So the tendency now is to refer to it in much more neutral terms. The usual term preferred now is female genital cutting.
Right, a slightly more neutral term. I mean, it seems to me that
I tend to prefer terms like that myself, and I'd be very happy to see male circumcision referred to as male genital cutting.
It's a very accurate term, and it's neutral. It's not, I mean, mutilation kind of makes a value judgment, presupposes.
FGC and MGC, they're very comparable procedures, and they should have similar terminology.
Right. A couple of other procedures that have some parallels with circumcision are tonsil removal and prophylactic mastectomy. I mean, let's talk about tonsils. When I was a kid in the 1960s, there was a rage. I was in England at the time. Everybody was getting their tonsils out. And I thought it was great because you had to eat ice cream for a week afterwards. That was the story I was told. I don't know if that was true because I guess you couldn't eat solid food. But my mother said, you definitely aren't getting your tonsils out. And then later, I believe that they discovered that there was actually some functional value when at that time it was believed by doctors and society in general there was no functional value to the tonsils.
Yeah, well, it was pretty routine. I remember getting my own tonsils removed. I would have been, four or five at the time. It wasn't routine in the sense that circumcision was. You usually had to have, you know, colds or something, and they thought, oh, well, maybe if we took his tonsils out, he wouldn't get so many colds or whatever it was.
Right.
But the point I make in my paper there is that this was a routine. It was actually very easy to give this particular routine up because nobody had strong feelings about the tonsils, whereas people do have strong feelings about the foreskin, both for and against.
Right.
And also, your tonsils are invisible. They have no sexual significance. They have no cultural significance.
Right, right.
Whether you remove them or not is a purely medical issue. People don't get emotional about it.
Yes, yeah, you're right. It's not tied to any cultures. And I think that even amongst parents, you know, maybe that have some Jewish heritage or something, and maybe something deep down, well, let's give a little nod towards our personal cultural history by circumcising our son or something. I'm sure that plays a role in it. One of the points you make with prophylactic mastectomy is that for some women, with certain genetic mutations, there's a pretty high statistical risk of getting breast cancer. And even so, removing the breasts is relatively rare partly because of their their function as, you know, for feeding infants, but probably more so because of their function as psychologically and sexually for women.
Yeah, well, they're symbols of femininity. Men like breasts, basically, so they have no wish to encourage women, even high-risk women, to prophylactically remove their breasts. That's right.
And I think women like their breasts, too. I don't think it's just men. Clothing.
Yes, generally speaking, people are in favor of breasts.
Yes, both sexes, I guess, can agree on that. But, I mean, it's part of your figure as a woman, it's part of your self-image, and although, you know, people can say it's just a little bit of flesh, I think psychologically it's a lot more than that. And so you're saying that, you know, we've got circumcision where the AAP, you know, which seems to be most of a mainstream order organization, is a little bit in favor, is saying there's not really a strong benefit, but with mastectomy, even when there's believed to be a strong benefit, there still doesn't happen that often because of the consequences.
Yeah, well, the medical benefit is considered less important than its psychological significance and its emotional significance. That most women would rather run the risk of getting cancer later and have their breasts for most of their lives.
It also seems to me that as a society, like if you looked at cancer, I mean, I think the role of, in my opinion, the role of infectious diseases and genes are overemphasized, and the role of environmental toxins is underemphasized. And we could probably reduce the risk of breast cancer and cervical cancer and all kinds of other cancers if we would remove a lot of toxic chemicals from our environment, if you remove toxic chemicals from the environment, it doesn't cause any harm to anybody when you do that, except maybe to somebody's wallet when the stock prices and the chemical companies go down. But we always kind of look at the you know, what surgery can we do, what pill can we give, as opposed to looking at broader.
You look for a point of easy intervention rather than something that's effective, and I think that's. That's really what the effort in Africa to circumcise men is really all about. That it's an easy quick intervention rather than something that's particularly sort of effective. Similarly, as you say, I mean, we mentioned cervical cancer earlier on. I think there's little doubt, and this is also true of cancer of the penis, that smoking is a very major, is a much more significant risk factor than whether or not you've got a foreskin.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we should work on smoking, improving the rates of breastfeeding, better diet, more exercise. I mean, those are things that actually improve people's lives and have a broad lessening of disease. Like if you're breastfed, it doesn't just reduce urinary tract infections. It reduces the risk of diabetes and a number of other things. And the same with eating a better diet or exercising more. It has a lot of physical and psychological benefits over a broad range. And these procedures tend to be very, very focused on one possible negative outcome, like breast cancer. Removing your breasts doesn't help you with cervical cancer or lung cancer or any other kind of cancer.
I think that's right. I think the social determinants of disease are very important and should be borne in mind. They're actually a lot more important than the poor little foreskin.
Right.
Just speaking of cancers, I might just mention one point of interest, which is probably not widely known. One of the major benefits of circumcision has always been supposedly reducing the risk of cancer of the penis, which is quite a rare disease of mostly old men. But it's worth pointing out that male breast cancer is significantly more common than cancer of the penis. So if you're going to start amputating things prophylactically, you better start with male breasts, not the foreskin.
Yes, I wonder how well that will go over. That's an interesting point.
They have no function, so you know.
Right. But I mean, I know you're being sarcastic, but even with men, a man who likes to look at himself in the mirror and say he looks good. I mean, the breasts, the upper chest is an important part of the body image.
Indeed. Exactly. I mean, the pecs these days are one of the major male beauty spots. So nobody's going to want to damage that.
Yes. I think men who are concerned about their self-image, which is, I think, most, would definitely be against that. I wanted to talk about a paper, which wasn't maybe a year ago, by a man named Brian Morris, who's also Australian, who's very, very pro-circumcision. And the paper, I believe, was retracted, or there's a consideration of retracting it, because it turned out that one of the only peer reviewer of the paper, I think a guy named Garen, was a friend and co-author with Brian Morris. Can you tell us anything about this little scandal that's happened?
Well, that paper was his reply to my paper in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal. I can't tell you anything about that because I didn't know anything about that until the Retraction Watch contacted me and said that there'd been this complaint about his paper and did I have any comment. So I sent them a fairly long comment and they quoted bits from that. That's all I know. I have no background or in background knowledge of that.
Except to say that
Brian Morris has a habit of anything I write, he tends to write something trying to rebut it.
Right. Well, I guess he tripped over his shoelaces in this case.
It wasn't new behavior on his part.
Right. But it doesn't say very much for the strength of your argument when you have to get a friend to do the peer review for you. It's almost like you don't want it to be peer reviewed by an actual independent scientist.
Well, what disappointed me about his reply, he didn't really tackle my central argument. My central argument in that paper was really about how the risk-benefit ratio that the AAP was using was not formulated correctly, that their idea that all that matters is the risks of surgical complications in the case of circumcision is missing the point, that that sort of calculation is designed for therapeutic procedures where there's actual pathology that needs to be fixed. If you're dealing with if you're dealing with a non-therapeutic amputation, you've got to consider the value of the body part that you're removing, and that's what they completely ignored.
Right, and
so that,
yeah,
so that was the central point of my my paper.
Right, I mean, a couple of points you made, which we did not mention, and I want to, are that there was no discussion. There was no discussion in the paper of the function of the foreskin, and also that the rate of adverse effects and the range and rate of adverse effects is really not very well known.
Well, in fact, the AAP admitted that although they claimed the benefits exceeded the risks, they actually admitted they couldn't calculate the risks.
That's BS, right? Like, if you can't calculate the risk, you cannot possibly say that the benefits outweigh the risks or vice versa.
Don't know. And as to the other point, I mean, indeed, if you're saying that it's okay to remove this particular body part, the first thing you ought to have done is to sort of assess, you know, what does that body part do? You know, what functions does it have? What value does it have for people? Which, again, they completely failed to do that.
Yes. Does money play a role in this? I mean, many medical procedures, it does. I mean, is there enough money being made from circumcisions that doctors sort of have a vested interest in keeping it going because it's an easy way to make money?
I really don't honestly know the answer to that. I think it's much more, I don't think the money can be all that great. Certainly most circumcisions in the United States are done by obstetricians anyway. That's one of the reasons why the pediatricians haven't had all that much impact in their sort of policies. So it happens as a kind of automatic phase or stage of the childbirth process. It's usually most boys are circumcised, you know, very soon after birth, before their mothers leave the hospital. So I don't think money is the major factor. I think the major factor is simply habit.
Yes.
It's just established habit that people are having difficulty breaking with.
Right. Well, you didn't think that we could talk for 55 minutes about this, but we have.
Oh, well, we've managed.
So is there any last, anything you'd like to add that we've missed in a pretty wide-ranging discussion?
Well, I'd just say to average American parent, there's no need to circumcise your baby boy. He'll be perfectly okay if you don't. And it's really something you don't have to worry about.
Yes. Like a lot of things, if we just go back to the way it was done 1,000 years ago, we'd probably be better off.
So that's my parting message.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Robert, for joining me today. I really appreciate this discussion. I did not realize that the issue was so broad and complicated.
Okay, great. It's been nice to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Infectious Myth. If you have suggestions for future guests or comments on the show, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.